This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This past December, a surprising study came out in the journal Science. The study showed that people could change the mind of voters on big issues like gay marriage and abortion. And all they needed was a short 20-minute chat face-to-face with those people. The results sounded almost too good to be true. This week, though, it obviously was. That paper was retracted by one of the authors. The data may have been completely made up. We ran the story on Science Friday. We believed it also. And joining me to talk about that finding, as well as other selected short subjects in science, is Rachel Feltman. She runs the Speaking of Science blog at The Washington Post. She's here in our New York studios. Good to see you back, Rachel.
Nice. Thanks for having me.
That retracted study in Science received a lot of attention. Like I say, we ran that story also.
Yeah, it was covered pretty much everywhere, I think. And everyone thought that it seemed miraculous. And the reason is that most studies have found the opposite to be true. When people have these strong convictions, if you present evidence as to why they shouldn't have those convictions, they actually kind of double down and feel even more strongly that you're wrong. Mm-hmm. So it seemed too good to be true that if someone came to you and explained why, as a gay person, they wanted you to support same-sex marriage, you should.
They thought that if you actually met people, right
that were, that was the key.
Yeah, that was
that
the key.
You needed
not
to humanize the issue. And unfortunately, the prominent professor who was one of the names on the study, Green, he has now asked for the study to be retracted. And his co-author, who's the one who handled all of the raw data, has asked for, he said that he stands by it, and that in a week he'll bring out definitive evidence. But the reason it seems that Green has been so transparent about asking for it to be retracted is that this supposedly was this huge scale study and huge scale data collection. So you would think that LaCour, the author who collected the data, would have some evidence ready to go to say, no, this really happened. There should be a huge paper trail. And he's not forthcoming with any of that.
So are they accusing him of just making up the stuff?
Well, it's really unclear what happened because he won't comment yet. And it may have been kind of a slippery slope that ended with complete fabrication, but it's very unclear. And it seems what happened is that a couple of grad students tried to reproduce the study because they found the results so impressive. And any important study has to be reproduced. But unfortunately, once they got into the process of reproducing it, they just found irregularity after irregularity, which they then brought to Green's attention. Mm.
Let's talk about another story, the stone tool that might predate, the oldest stone tool ever found?
So this is a stone tool found in Kenya that's 3.3 million years old, which is almost a million years older than the oldest one found previously. And it's very simple, but the reason it's exciting is that this predates our genus, Homo, the famous handyman Homo habilis, who conventionally we thought was the first species to use tools. And so it could be that an entirely different genus was actually the first tool user. And it's cool because the hand actions used to create the markings on the tool are more primitive. They're rudimentary. Mm. They're more like what you see an ape doing, trying to break a nut open. But the intention is clearly to make a tool. So it's a very neat kind of missing link between not knowing how to make tools at all and making what Homo habilis made.
Well, how old is the tool that they made?
3.3 million years.
Oh, isn't that where Lucy is? Lucy's
yeah,
at that time?
It would have been a contemporary of Lucy. And there's a contender because there's a species that was found very close to the tool that has been named as a new species and genus. It's different from anything we've found before. And it's possible that was a precursor to Homo.
Exciting. Let's talk about 3D printing. Something new with 3D printing?
Sure, yeah. So 3D printing skin, actually.
Skin?
Yes. L'Oreal, the cosmetics company, has announced that they're partnering with a medical 3D printing company to 3D print cell by cell, layer by layer, human skin, which sounds very creepy, but it's actually less creepy than what they do now. To avoid animal testing, they actually take scraps donated from plastic surgery and grow them into mats of human skin. And in a year, it takes 60 scientists a year to make a cowhide worth of human skin. That's their analogy, not mine. Again,
it's
very creepy.
Yeah.
So the idea is that they'll be able to 3D print on demand all different types of skin for testing.
Well, wait a minute. You mean you load up a 3D printer with skin cells?
I mean, basically.
And you just print it out and you get tissue, like it becomes skin, a size, name, shape that you could draw a diagram in it of a name if you want?
Yeah, the same way people are trying to bioprint organs.
Yeah.
You know, you just kind of load up the right stem cells and do it layer by layer.
Wow. Let's talk about another story, the fossil in Washington State.
Yeah, Washington State was the 37th state to find their first dinosaur fossil. And the researchers involved actually think it may be the last state to find its first dinosaur fossil. Washington was kind of the last holdout where we could expect to find a dinosaur and hadn't found one yet. And it was this big bone that once they dug it out of the rock, they found signs that it was a land animal. And because of the size, that meant there was a pretty good chance it was some kind of dinosaur. Then they found out the bone was hollow, which is a trademark of birds that came from dinosaurs. And then they went around trying to compare it to known dinosaur bones from the same era, and sure enough, they found a match. So,
what kind? Was it a meat eater? Or what?
Well, so they know it was a theropod, which is the same group that T-Rex is in, but it's hard to tell anything else.
Well, we'll wait for the next bones.
Yeah.
You can't just have one dinosaur anywhere. Finally, you got a quirky panda story. This is amazing.
Yeah, so it turns out that pandas actually have very weird gut bacteria. Their gut bacteria seems to be left over from back when they were carnivores, even though for 2 million years they've been eating nothing but bamboo. So giant pandas are actually only able to digest something like 17% of the 30 pounds of bamboo they eat every day.
No kidding.
Yeah, and the biome in their gut has just not changed at all. And they're able to do this because they've adapted to just sit around eating tons of food and pooping most of it undigested. And they do just fine that way.
Well, they would have to eat a lot of food because they're not digesting most of it.
Yeah, they're eating
right?
Like four times as much food as they would if they had the proper bacteria.
Could we give them, you know, a hamburger and see if they would eat it? I mean, they have the gut bacteria for that, right?
That's a good question.
All right, I'm not going to tell the National Zoo or whatever, anybody in China, what to do. Thank you, Rachel, for taking time. Those are fascinating stories. Rachel Feltman, she runs the Speaking of Science blog in Washington Post. Thanks, Rachel. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Earlier this week, a study came out in the journal Nature Chemical Biology that talked about the possibility for engineering yeast, yes, the same stuff that makes bread rise and helps brew beer, engineering yeast to be able to turn sugar into opiate drugs, such as morphine. It hasn't been done yet, but researchers have mapped out a good deal of the pathway that would need to be created. And here to play Good Thing, Bad Thing with me is Megan Palmer. She used to be a bioengineer herself, and now she's a research fellow studying policy and biosafety at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me.
Ready to play Good Thing, Bad Thing?
I sure am.
All right. Give us the good thing about this.
Well, the good news is that researchers are getting better at building biology-based platforms to produce a whole wide variety of compounds that are difficult, inefficient, and sometimes just impossible to create through other means. So researchers are improving these tools to make biosynthetic pathways, combining enzymes that are able to do chemical transformations and convert low-value compounds into high-value compounds. So in this case, we're using yeast, and we can use these platforms to produce not just drugs, but also other things like materials or fuels or scents.
Mm-hmm. Why,
so the researchers, go ahead.
Now I'm just going to ask, why is this an advantage over the way we do things now?
So there are many different ways that we gain access to the drugs that the researchers showed this week. Mostly they're agricultural-based productions, and sometimes these can be unreliable, sourced from many other places. And some of the types of drugs that we want access to that are derivatives of these, we can more easily modify them in these yeast-based platforms. And so some of these are things like anti-cancer agents and also potentially cheaper or more efficient drugs to replace current opiates that might be less prone to abuse.
All right, so
but overall, the really good news is that we haven't gone through this entire pathway yet, and researchers are engaging on the topic of how to produce them safely and efficiently up front.
And that's good that they're engaging it, because that is part of the bad thing.
Yes, so there is some bad news here. The great news is we have a chance to get ahead of this right now. But one significant concern is that if we put the full pathway to go from glucose to this intermediate and then all the way to things like morphine, then this could actually feed into illicit markets and bolster new illicit markets. So the worry this week that was prominently discussed was around producing heroin. So because yeast is a platform to allow decentralized production, it means that if this were to be made robust and integrated, it could leak out, and it could allow sort of this homebrew option for producing narcotics that are a significant problem.
How easy is that, though, to do that?
Right now, there's a lot of expert knowledge really required to both integrate the pathway and also to make it come to scale and produce significant amounts of the compound. And so some estimates are, you know, several years and a lot of expert knowledge, including a PhD in bioengineering. But if the full pathway were to be integrated, that would be a concern. So the good news is we have choices both in the engineering design and in the regulation.
And so we'll just keep an eye on this, see how this...
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great things happening, but also a lot of difficult policy concerns.
You know, why does that sound familiar? Yeah. Thank you, Megan. Dr. Megan Palmer, Research Fellow at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University. We're going to take a break when we come back. Spring, that means it's the seed season. We're going to talk all about seeds. If you have questions, please... be happy to take them from you. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. After a long, interminable winter here in the East, spring is finally here, and that means it's seed planting and seed sprouting season. You know, seeds aren't just for your backyard garden. They're in fibers in your clothes, and you might have a handful for breakfast. But how often have you stopped to look at seed close up? My next guest has cracked open a few seeds in his life. He did his graduate research on the rock-hard seed of the almendro tree of Central America. He crawled through coal mines to find the origin of spores and is here to take us through the incredible diversity of seeds. Tor Hansen is a biologist and author of the new book, The Triumph of Seeds. Welcome to Science Friday.
Well, thanks for having me on, Ira.
This is an amazing book. Tell us about some of the interesting stuff that you did your graduate research in this almendro seed. Why are you so interested in seeds?
Well, the almendro is a fascinating rainforest tree in Central America that's something of a keystone for the forest on the Caribbean side of the isthmus. And it produces copious amounts of fruit that contain these huge, hard seeds that a lot of different creatures rely on for food. So I did my research studying how these seeds were dispersed and studying their genetics. And at the end of it all, after the papers had been written and published, I thought to myself, well, this is great, but, you know, I still don't really understand how seeds work. You know, how do they germinate? How do they lie dormant in the soil? All of these questions were still there. So it sent me on a path of trying to identify the key evolutionary innovations that seeds came up with that have made them so dominant in nature. And when you look at those key traits, you realize that, hey, these are the very same reasons that we're so utterly dependent upon seeds for everything from our food to the cotton in our clothes to hydraulic fracturing, for that matter. All of these things dependent in one way or another on the wonderful biology of seeds.
You have one great, you talk about key adaptations over the years. There's a plant called the Java cucumber. You call it the king of dispersal. There's a video of that that was just unbelievable. Describe it for us.
Yeah, the Javan cucumber is a really amazing seed. It is from a vine that twines up into the rainforest canopy in Indonesia, and it sets loose these seeds that drift on the wind for miles. You know, sailors on ships would find these things landing on the deck of the ships long before botanists ever figured out what plant they were coming from. The seed is a very thin single wing, beautifully aerodynamic, that can drift and steady itself in flight and go for miles and miles. And there's a wonderful story about it, because the early aviator Ego Ettrick, who designed some early airplanes right after the turn of the century, based his designs on the Javan cucumber seed because it was so aerodynamic and efficient in flight.
It's beautiful. It looks like a glider. You know,
it's gliding. It's a wonderful.
Right? It's not spinning like, you know, you see some of the polynoses and things we saw as kids. This thing is gliding like a glider. It's just fantastic.
Yeah. Wonderful glider.
Yeah, let's talk about seedless plants, seedless watermelons and fruits like that. How do you make watermelons without seeds? Is there a chicken and egg thing going on here?
Well, of course, traditionally, watermelons did have seeds. And in fact, I received a letter from a woman who had heard about the book, and she really wanted to know how to bring the seeds back into watermelons. And of course, you can simply by growing the heirloom varieties. Mm-hmm. But a seedless watermelon is made by crossing a normal watermelon, which has one set of chromosomes from each of the parent watermelon plants, with a watermelon whose chromosomes have been doubled. And so when you do that, you get a watermelon with three sets of chromosomes. And you cannot divide three equally. So when that watermelon tries to produce seeds, the seeds are infertile, just the little white seed coats that you see there in the seedless watermelon.
But didn't we have seedless oranges before we had genetic engineering? Didn't Luther Burbank work with all kinds of stuff? And
yeah, there are ways to get around it. And in fact, this idea of doubling chromosomes and crossing is something that does happen in nature. A wide variety of plant species have doubled or tripled the number of their chromosomes. Mm-hmm. So we do see some seedless varieties develop that people have then kept going through, grafting and other means.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you look at a few record-breaking seed. There is a date palm named Methuselah. Tell us about it.
Oh, Methuselah is a marvelous story. It's all about this idea of dormancy. How long can a seed lie dormant in the soil, and how do they do it? And the record holder right now is this marvelous date palm that was excavated in an archaeological dig in Israel, a very famous site there called Masada, which was a fortress overrun by the Romans. So the archaeologists found all kinds of interesting things in that dig, including a trove of these old Judean dates that had been in the food stores there. And the Judean date has since disappeared. No one grows it anymore, but here they were. So the archaeologists, they put numbers on these things and put them in a drawer somewhere. But a few years ago, some botanists got a hold of some of these seeds and decided to plant them. And one of them sprouted and grew into a healthy Judean date palm after nearly 2,000 years lying in the rubble under Masada.
How are they able to do that? How are they able to stay dormant and viable? After so long.
It's still something of a mystery how dormancy actually works. It has to do in part with desiccation, with losing the water out of a seed. And then this amazing ability of those desiccated cells to retake water at germination and retain a memory of form and function. So you can't really do this with most cells. You couldn't do it with most animal cells. If you take the water out, the cell is dead. But desiccated dormant seed cells retain a memory of form and function, and they come back essentially to life when water goes back into them.
Yeah, there is a measles vaccine that has been developed based on seed dormancy, correct?
Yeah, it's something that people are studying for all kinds of reasons, not just to understand how seeds do it, but to try to figure out ways that we can use this. And the one of the marvelous ways we've learned to do it is by taking measles vaccine and inserting it into what's called a bioglass, myo-inositol from grains of rice. And it led to the first real dry vaccine, the sort of vaccine that will stay alive long enough to reach remote parts of the developing world, where it's always been a challenge to provide vaccinations because the vaccines were live and needed to be refrigerated. So now, by copying the dormancy of seeds, we're able to provide dry vaccines to remote areas.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Seeds are still evolving different strategies. Is there a highly evolved seed, one that you would point out more than the others?
Oh, I think that's a great question. You see some great seed innovations in how they lie dormant, in how they provide nutrition to the baby plant, and how they travel and all these things. But one of the most highly evolved seeds actually has evolved away from many of those traits and is still extremely successful. And those are the seeds found in orchids, which is, you know, our, one of our largest plant families, extremely successful, 20, 25,000, maybe even 30,000 different species of orchids in the world. And orchid seeds are tiny little blips. They're tiny little blips that have hardly any of those characteristics that make a seed a seed. And they have learned to do this, and they have mastered a new strategy, which is to pair with a fungus in the soil that provides them with the nutrition that they need to sprout.
Yeah. And I've been growing orchids for 30 years, and I've yet to see a seed. But that was, you know, that was one of the mistakes about orchids back in the day, meaning 40, 50 years ago, that people thought it was so hard to grow them because the seeds were so hard to deal with. But that's nobody deals with seeds at your local nursery anymore.
Right, right. And the seed challenge was really, it had to do with the fungus. You could take an orchid seed and plant it in the best potting soil from the garden store and fertilize it and water it and pray to the full moon, and that thing would never do anything unless you had the right fungus there in that soil mix.
Well, and seed shortages have sparked political revolutions, have they not?
Yeah, we're so deeply entwined in seeds, you know, throughout daily life. And of course, one of the main things is simply as a food source. We get more than half of our calories and more than half of our protein from seeds, from the grains and from legumes and other things in our diet. And if you look at the history of grains, you gain a real appreciation for the gatherer side of the hunter-gatherer legacy. We often focus on the hunters and the stone tools, but it's really the gathering people who have left us the greatest legacy through agriculture. And you see that whenever over time civilizations have run short of primarily the seeds of grasses, the grains and cereals, you see political revolutions likely to take place. This played a role in the fall of Rome. Rome used to import wheat from Egypt and North Africa every year, and they had a very elaborate dole where they gave an allotment of grain to every citizen. This is the one half of the bread and circuses way they kept people happy in that era. They even had a goddess who was dedicated to the grain dole and giving it out. So when the grain imports dried up, it wasn't and the grain dole ended, it wasn't too long after that, that Rome fell. But that trend has continued throughout history. You see bread shortages, grain shortages preceding everything from the French Revolution all the way up to the Arab Spring, which occurred in a year following great drought in Russia and North America when grain prices shot up and the supplies dwindled.
Well, Tor, this is fascinating stuff, and it's a lot of it is in your new book, The Triumph of Seeds, a terrific spring reading and summer. It's certainly people like us who like to plant seeds, and they're just magnificent. We wonder how they work. Yeah. Thank you, Tor.
You're very welcome.
Tor Hansen is a biologist and, as I say, author of the new book, The Triumph of Seeds. And you can read an excerpt of this book on our website at sciencefriday.com/seeds. course, seeds and the plants they grow into are astonishingly diverse. But over time, we've lost thousands of crop varieties, and that's not just bad news for heirloom tomato fans. Imagine losing a strain of drought-resistant corn in this era of the mega drought. So it's important to try and save as many varieties as you can, right, before they go bye-bye. Well, my next guest has made seed saving a lifelong quest. In 2008, he helped open the Svalbard Seed Bank. It's sort of a global Noah's Ark for seeds, buried frozen deep underneath a Norwegian mountain. It's even asteroid-proof. Now, Carrie Fowler is the subject of a documentary that takes us deep inside that doomsday vault and other seed banks around the globe. Carrie Fowler is the former executive director of the Global Crop Diversity Trust. Good to have you back.
Thank you.
And Sandy McLeod is the director and producer of a new documentary called Seeds of Time. Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome to have nice to have you both here. We talked to you, Carrie, back way back in when the Doomsday Vault opened. You said that you had 269,000 samples. Your number today is
864,000.
Wow! Wait, and Sandy, why make a movie about seeds? I don't think many people would call seeds inherently dramatic. You know?
No, and that's right. In fact, when I called my lawyer to tell him I was making a film about seeds, he said, I'm sorry, you're going to have to spell that for me. It sounds like you're saying seeds.
Not weeds or something.
When I began to realize the importance of seeds and look at them in a way that I'd never looked at them before, I thought maybe a few other people need to think about this, too.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about seeds with Carrie Fowler and Sandy McLeod. And we're talking about a new documentary and a book. What was it like, Sandy, filming inside the Doomsday Vault? A little chilly in there for you?
It was a little chilly, but I have to say that after shooting outside the seed vault, it felt warmer in there.
It was colder outside.
Wind chill.
Well, Carrie, how did you pick the spot? How do you decide where you're going to put a seed vault?
Well, it was pretty easy if you think about the process of elimination and all the places it wouldn't work, because what you really want to do if you're trying to build a facility that's going to provide a lot of safety and security for existing seed collections that are housed in other seed banks is you want a place that's remote and accessible, and you want it to be cold, really cold, because the seeds will be conserved for the longest amount of time if they're both frozen and, as your previous guest mentioned, dry. And we can accomplish that inside this mountain where we weren't totally dependent on mechanical cooling apparatus.
Yeah, so you don't have to spend money cooling it down.
We do. The optimal temperature for this kind of venture is about minus 18 Celsius.
Wow.
But we get about minus 5 for free inside this mountain, so we only have about 13 degrees to go.
Carrie, in the film, you call climate change the single greatest challenge agriculture has ever faced. Explain that to us.
Well, it absolutely is. We're headed towards climates that have never existed before in the 12,000-year history of agriculture. We're quite close, in fact. And mid-century, more than half of the countries in Africa will be experiencing climate temperature regimes over more than half of their territory that hasn't been experienced since the dawn of agriculture. So I think the obvious question that we as a society need to be asking is how well adapted are our crops to climates and all the associated variables that come with that that haven't been experienced before. And I think we would be an exceptionally lucky species ourselves if our major food sources came pre-adapted to climates that they themselves had never experienced.
Does it bother you when people call global warming a hoax then?
Well, sure. I think the data is overwhelming. Last month was the 362nd consecutive month in which the global average temperature for that month exceeded the 20th century average for that particular month. So that's a lot of coincidence. As Mae West said, some figures add up to a lot. And But on the other hand, I think it's really important for us to sometimes put aside some of the politics when we deal with this particular issue. And I think this is an ideal issue to put the politics aside, because the one thing we can agree on, whether we agree that there's global warming or not, or what the cause of global warming is, I think all of us can agree that we've had a lot of bad weather.
Yeah. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back talking about the seed bank after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In case you just joined us, we're talking this hour about preserving the dwindling varieties of seeds. How can we save the gene diversity in our food crops? That's the subject of a new documentary out today called Seeds of Time. Sandy McLeod directed the film. She's here with us. Carrie Fowler is the subject of the movie. He's a former executive director of the Global Crop Diversity Trust, where he helped found the Svalbard Global Seed Vault way up there in the frozen Norwegian mountains. Let me ask you, Sandy, you also visited not only the seed bank, but you visited the Vavilov Seed Bank in St. Petersburg. Tell us the story of how that seed bank got to be what it was.
Well, there was a guy named Vavilov, and he began to realize that we were losing a lot of diversity. This is around in the 20s, and he started traveling the world and collecting this diversity. And unfortunately, things were bad in his hometown in Leningrad, and he became very unpopular with Stalin, and so he had this incredible seed bank and this incredible collection, and had garnered a lot of worldwide attention, and had figured out that seeds that were growing longest in certain parts of the world that was a center of origin for those seeds, and that's where you found the greatest diversity. So he had this incredible collection. And yet, because of the political climate, he was arrested, and he eventually starved to death in prison. And the people that worked at the seed bank, also a number of them starved to death with the seeds still on their desks, because they realized that what they had, and they were hoping that when the world was sane again, that the seeds could be used and would still be there.
How ironic. They're starving. There are the seeds around them, and they just would rather starve than eat the bank of seeds.
It was during the period of the Nazi siege of Leningrad, so there were 900 days in which the Nazis had surrounded the town, and a lot of residents were starving to death. But you're right. Here were people in a building with large collections of seeds who didn't eat those seeds because they realized the importance of them for the future.
What happened to the collection?
Still there.
Oh, yeah.
It's in the same building.
It is still there, but it's not safe even now. I mean, it's a threatened collection.
That's why you need the backup seed vault in Norway.
That's a big reason for it, because I really don't think that any country in the world has fully appreciated or manifested that appreciation for these seed collections. Our own National Seed Bank in Fort Collins, Colorado, has recently gotten budget cuts, and given the kind of challenges we're facing in the world, this is really not the kind of thing to cut, particularly since it's so cost-effective.
It's hard to believe that. We have budget cuts to this, our own National Seed Bank?
Well, that's right. So you can imagine what's happening in many developing countries around the world. And again, that's why we need something like the Svalbard Global Seed Vault.
Didn't we cut the national budget like by 10%?
Something about 8%, I think.
Wow.
Recently.
Wow.
Recently.
I understand that even the rural Peruvian potato farmers are sending their potatoes to the Svalbard Vault, right?
That's right.
People all over the world send you stuff?
Well, not individuals. Yeah. We typically deal with institutions because, as you know, eventually all seeds will deteriorate and stop germinating. So we really need to have an institution on the other side. And the seed vault operates like a safety deposit box where an institution will send a safety duplicate copy of their collection for safekeeping, and it's free for them to do it, so it's a bit of a no-brainer.
Sandy, what makes him such a good subject for a film?
Well, his, you know, he's probably done more than anyone else I can think of in the world to as a single individual, he's done something that affects every single one of us. Every time we look at our plate, we can thank Carrie and Vavilov and a number of other people too. But that food is more secure than it's ever been.
Mm-hmm. Is the future of the seed bank and other seed banks, are they secure? You talked about budget cuts to our own around the world, or how safe is the one, the main one in Norway?
Well, that one is very safe.
Yeah.
Nobody can make guarantees in this life about what will happen, but that's about as safe as it can be. It's 130 yards into a mountain and about the same distance from the top. It's really safe. But it's the backup copy, and the working seed banks that supply researchers and plant breeders, I don't think a single one of them has a secure multi-year budget. And I tell people that, gosh, conserving seeds is not something that you want to do 49 out of the next 50 years. It really has to be 50 out of 50. And when we lose that diversity, we lose options. We lose the traits that are going to be useful in the future.
Do you have seeds that are found nowhere else in the world in your bank?
Oh, I'm sure. The seed vault itself is probably mostly populated with seed varieties that are no longer grown by farmers. That doesn't mean they're bad varieties. That means that the farmers replaced them by varieties they thought were better at the time, but the older varieties might contain perhaps not the ideal combination of traits for the farmer, but an ideal and perhaps unique trait that will be needed in the future.
Like drought resistance,
or disease resistance or something like that.
Heat tolerance.
Yeah, we're going to need a lot of heat tolerance.
Definitely.
Well, thank you, Sandy, for making the film. The film is called Seeds of Time. It's out today. Available for viewing everywhere?
Or? In New York, and then May 29th in L.A.
And Harry Fowler is subject of the movie. He's former executive director of the Global Crop Diversity Trust, where he helped found the Svalbard Global Seed Vault. Thank you for what you do.
Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Thank you.
May is National Melanoma Skin Cancer Awareness Month. Did you know that? If you're heading out for sun and fun this holiday weekend, take along the sunscreen. Don't just take it, use it. Normal human skin cells contain a lot of sun-induced mutations in their DNA, according to new research. Listen to this. About a quarter of the cells, though functioning normally in your skin, may be on the road to becoming skin cancer. Researchers took samples of human skin cells, and by sequencing the DNA in those skin samples, they were able to observe the mutations that can accumulate in skin cells over time. And they found mutations occurring as often as one per day. Joining me now to talk about it is Philip Jones. He's a research team leader in precancer at the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute in Cambridge, UK, and one of the authors of a paper on the work out this week in the journal Science. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
How many mutations are we talking about?
Well, we reckon that in sun-exposed normal human skin, this actually comes from eyelids, because some people get baggy eyelids when they get old and they get bits of skin removed, and that's what we were able to study because it's normally thrown away. So in normal eyelids, we found about 140 clumps of cells carrying mutations in a square centimeter, so about the size of your fingernail. So that's a lot of groups of cells carrying mutations which are linked with cancer.
Hmm. And how do the mutations get there?
Well, we're very confident that they get there from sunlight. Some of the sunlight you can't see, that's the ultraviolet bit, changes DNA, but it changes it in a very particular way. It's as if it signs the changes that it leaves. And all of these mutations pretty much had this signature of being caused by sunlight.
Mm-hmm. So these cells are on their way to becoming cancerous, but they're not cancerous yet.
We know from a huge global effort that's looked at the DNA changes in many cancers, but you need maybe half a dozen, maybe 10 changes, particular changes in genes to cause cancer. And these cells, as far as we know, are carrying maybe one or two of those. So they've taken a couple of steps down the road, but they absolutely haven't got there.
Do we know how many mutations it does take, cumulatively?
I think it depends on the kind of cancer, and that's a very actively area of research at the moment. What I would say, given that we have lots and lots of normal cells carrying these changes, it means that actually we're very well defended against the progression towards cancer. Our skin has evolved to deal and contain these groups of cells carrying the alterations. So I think it's a very good motivation, this study, to carry on using your sunscreen. The sort of cells we look at, they don't grow into the melanoma. They grow into the other sorts, the rodent ulcers, squamous cell cancers. But it's a very good motivation to carry on using sunscreen. And I particularly say that to older people, because certainly a lot of the 50-plus-year-olds I meet kind of look in the mirror and say it's not worth bothering anymore. But actually, it really is worth bothering with sunscreen, because the people we looked at in the study were in their 50s, and they have stacked up quite a lot of cells that have taken one or two steps. If you use sunscreen, you give a chance of not taking the next few.
Is it
down the road to cancer?
Well, if you do use the sunscreen, and I think it probably is news to a lot of people like us who are over 50, they think, you know, I've already damaged my skin. What the heck? I'm, you know, getting a little more sun. But you're saying it does make a difference. Is it possible to reverse any of those mutations? Can the skin can its skin heal itself, I guess?
Well, that's a really good question. As far as we know, and in the past we've studied the behavior of cells in the skin in some depth, and what I would say is if you've got a square centimeter or, you know, of skin taken over by a clump of cells with a mutation, it's very unlikely you can lose that without some help. And a big focus of our future research, which we can do in human cells but also in transgenic mice, is to understand whether we can give particular treatments that would give the altered cells a disadvantage so they get lost. And that's going to be a very interesting area to look at in the future.
Is there any, because these are random occurrences, is there any possibility that you might help a cell being mutated instead of hurt it?
Well, all of the groups of cells we could detect, the limits of the technology meant we could only detect quite large groups. So all of the things we detected had very much an advantage over their neighbors. They outcompeted their neighbors for space. But it very interestingly, one of the mutations that we found is not associated with cancer at all. In fact, the very biggest groups of cells carried a mutation that is linked with a benign skin change. It's something called a seborrheic keratosis, long word, but it's a fleshy sort of lump that you and I and most listeners will get one or two of or more in their lives. It's not a cancer. And this would suggest that you can separate having a growth advantage at this very early stage from going down the subsequent evolutionary route, if you like, into cancer. Yeah. And that's a very interesting possibility, because it says, well, if you can protect against the development of cancer with a mutation, seemingly, does that mean there might be treatments that we could offer that would do a similar thing?
Right. Talking with Philip Jones, research team leader in precancer at the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute in Cambridge, UK, on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Do these mutations tell you anything about which kinds of cancers? Can you look at a mutation and say, oh, it might evolve to this kind versus another kind?
Well, the kind we found most commonly were associated with something called squamous cell skin cancer. Again, it's a long word, but these are things that you would notice. They're not the moles. They're not mole cancers. They're sort of lumps that wouldn't heal or something on your skin. They'd get progressively bigger over time, and you should definitely go and see your physician about them and get them removed. If they're caught early, they're easy to deal with. If they're left for a long time, they're not easy to deal with. So they're definitely, if you think you've got a change in a lump in your skin, you should definitely go and get it checked out. Mm-hmm. But the mutations, the changes we found, were strongly linked with that kind of cancer. Mm-hmm. We didn't find changes linked with an even commoner kind of cancer called basal cell cancer. And in Caucasians, in people with pale skin, that's the commonest kind of cancer by far. We didn't find mutations which were associated with that. Hmm. That doesn't mean they're not there, but it was an interesting lack.
You know, for the holiday goers here in the States, this is a big holiday weekend, the start of the summer season. Can sunblock really keep out, protect you from these mutations?
What I think it, so I think if you want to totally avoid any mutations, you should stay indoors all the time and never see the sun, and you would be very miserable, and you would have a deficiency in a vitamin called vitamin D. You need a little bit of sun to make enough of this essential vitamin. But what you can use sunblock for is to keep your skin exposure to the sun quite low. And we talk about practicing safe sun. So that means don't go out, you know, 10 a.m. through 2 p.m. When the sun is brightest. Do cover up your skin and do use sunblock for areas like your hands and your face, which are regularly getting sun exposure, particularly if you live in the southern latitudes in the States where you're going to get a lot more sun exposure. This makes a huge difference to how these groups of altered cells develop. We showed that a few years ago. And they basically really like it with regular low doses of sunshine. They will, it will increase their advantage over their neighbors if you give them that. So you're kind of helping to halt their further changes and stop them expanding when you use sunblock.
Well, Dr. Jones, you may have saved someone's life this weekend. So my hat's off to you for giving us this advice. Philip Jones is a research team leader in precancer at the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute in Cambridge in the UK. Thank you for joining us today with that advice.
Thank you very much.
That's about all the time we have for this hour. Charles Berquist is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata, Alexa Lim, our associate producer, our SIATS producer, Annie Minoff, Lou Groskin, our video producer, our production assistant, Becky Fogel, Rich Kim, our technical director, and Sarah Fishman is our engineer at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. If you want to hear any part, go to our website at sciencefriday.com. Listen to our podcast. You can download our app and listen to our podcast on there also. You can also write us, send us email, and we tweet all week. At SciFry is our handle. And as I say, you can participate on our website all week long. Have a great and safe holiday weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.